Okay, so we'll go right ahead and transition to this panel discussion. What I'd like to do to begin is to invite the panelists to introduce themselves spend maybe about 2 to 3 minutes just talking about international experience that you're responsible for and how you've integrated that into the curriculum. Just very briefly, we can flesh things out a bit later. So we begin on my extreme left. Thanks.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm not Andy Murtha. Who's my colleague and current director of the China and Asia Pacific Studies program. But Andy has another commitment, so I'm attending in his stead. My name is Xu Xin. I'm associate director of the CAPS program. It's really a great pleasure and honor to represent CAPS at this symposium. Let me just say a few words about our program. I was really encouraged early on this morning by the keynote speech by Mr. Charles and by our vice provost because that really reinforced my confidence about the CAPS program, which is internationalized program to begin with. In other words, the CAPS program has built in internationalization curriculum. Let me just very briefly highlight a few key natures or features of the CAPS program. The internationalization or internationalized curriculum is manifested in every aspect of the program. Number one is shown in our basic course offerings. The required courses for the CAPS majors and the minors are all more or less about China or China-US relations. Number two, the internationalization also particularly manifested in our language requirements. Our majors are required to take 4 years of Chinese language trainings. If you start from scratch, that means you have to take Chinese course every semester until you reach the level of the fourth year college Mandarin proficiency. Number three, the curriculum also has an integral component of off-campus or overseas experiences for students. Our students in their junior year and senior years are required to spend 1 semester in Washington, D.C., basically, which is they stayed at Cornell in Washington Center. And in Beijing, in Peking University, our key strategic partner. While they are there, they take courses, but also they are undertaking internships, which are also required by the curriculum. Finally, maybe two more. The students' career paths, also the great evidence of the successful internationalization curriculum we have. And about a third of our graduates have been working or studying in countries like China or other Asian countries. And those who are working here in this country, many of them also have international outlook in their careers. Finally, our strategic partnership with Peking University is really essential to the successful operation of our curriculum. So let me stop here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Yes.
Hello, I think this is a microphone. Can everyone hear me? So my name's Liz Brundage. I direct the Global Gender Justice Clinic at Cornell Law School, and also I'm executive director of the Avon Global Center for Women and Justice. I'm here today to talk about the Global Gender Justice Clinic. So the Global Gender Justice Clinic was launched just this year, this past fall, but it's really one of a number of internationalized clinics at the law school that include the International Human Rights Clinic that I've co-taught in the past, the Advancing Human Rights at Home and Abroad Clinic, and another of other clinical opportunities that more occasionally include international work. The Global Gender Justice Clinic, like other clinics, is both a law school course as well as a public interest law firm, a human rights law firm. And so we take on cases and projects that seek to advance gender justice around the world. We work with organizations and individuals using international human rights law, language, and methodologies in an effort to advance gender justice. And students are really the ones who are doing this work. Through both the critical seminar as well as their practical project work, about 8 to 10 students in a given semester, working in teams under close faculty supervision, will examine and engage in local, global, and transnational efforts to combat gender violence and discrimination. We do this through really a diversity of different endeavors. We're particularly diverse in methodologies. Students may participate in domestic, regional, or international litigation, engage with human rights bodies, draft or analyze proposed legislation, conduct fact-finding or reporting, engage in public awareness and education activities, or pursue other human rights strategies. Some projects give students the opportunity to travel abroad, while others really seek to use human rights law and language to bring human rights home. So just to give a few concrete examples, in the past year, the clinic has worked on projects in which students themselves have, for example, filed a petition before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of 27 survivors of military sexual assault in the United States. Our students submitted shadow reports to the UN Human Rights Council and the United Nations Committee Against Torture, also on the topic of military sexual violence in the U.S. And then students traveled to Geneva and advocated before countries and before the committee quite successfully, resulting in recommendations by both human rights bodies calling upon the U.S. to take action on this topic. Students drafted a resolution recognizing freedom from domestic violence as a fundamental human right, and they successfully advocated for its adoption by 6 local legislative bodies here in Tompkins County, engaging in broad community outreach and now working on trying to implement the resolution's recommendations. They conducted research and developed a field research protocol for looking at the issue of women in prisons in Jamaica, and we're planning to take students to Jamaica either this summer or in the fall. We collaborated with a human rights clinic at the University of Nairobi Law School on the issue of sexual violence against girls in schools, and we co-hosted a working group of stakeholders in Kenya around these issues in January, and our students and the students from the law school in Kenya collaborated on that endeavor. We launched a study of the relationship between women's economic empowerment and domestic violence globally, which seeks to look at how economic empowerment initiatives could be used to address the issue of domestic violence. And then we conducted pre-litigation research in preparation for international advocacy relating to discrimination and violence against lesbian and bisexual women. And so these international experiences are in every way integrated into students, into the course, into our classroom sessions, into our team meetings. We really encourage students to take ownership over their projects, but we also provide really intensive supervision and encourage students to integrate theory and practice. Our class includes training in some of the substantive aspects of international human rights, training in relevant skills, but also an opportunity to step back and encourage students to think critically about their work. And really, in all of these ways, the clinic self-consciously is internationalized in its methodological focus, in its substantive engagement in global gender justice issues, in its involvement of some students in international travel, and in bringing international tools here to advocacy in the United States.
Hi, I'm David Pelletier from the Division of Nutritional Sciences. And I'd like to speak about two curricular models that we have for internationalization. One, the Global Health Minor, which began about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and more recently, the Global and Public Health Sciences Major, which we just launched this year. These illustrate really two different ways to do it, and they each have their own advantages, so I'd like to say a little bit about both, briefly.
Sure.
The minor is available to students across the university, regardless of their major. In order to get the minor in global health, they need to take the capstone course, usually in their sophomore year, take a number of courses as selectives, do 8 weeks experience in a low-income country, and then when they return, take the capstone course, where they integrate some of what they observed and experienced in the field with some academic knowledge and produce some sort of a solution to a global health-related problem. So that's the minor. It started out with, I believe, 15 students 6 years ago, and then grew successively to now 60 students go out usually every summer to do their 8 weeks in a low-income country. So one of the great advantages there is it's available across the university regardless of the major. And then just this year we launched the Global and Public Health Sciences major, which will have students doing very much the same thing abroad, but other students that are focusing on public health domestically. Both categories will take the same set of core courses. Freshman year, a core course in public health with mostly a domestic focus. All of them then take the global health core course, regardless of whether they're going to be domestically focused or international, take epidemiology, do their experiential learning either in a summer or during a semester, and then all of them are in the same capstone course, which I think is very exciting. That's the course that I teach, where they will see some of the similarities as well as the differences across the domestic setting and the low-income international settings. So we anticipate that this major probably will grow to, I'm guessing, about 100 students at full implementation. We can say a lot more in the Q&A.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Thank you
very much.
Yes, please.
Hi, Madeline Finkel, representing the medical school, and I'm delighted, even though we are off-site, we're not out of mind, so thank you. And we have a long tradition of globalization in the medical school curriculum, starting back with the legendary Dr. Benjamin Keene, who was quite a colorful guy. He was a tropical disease specialist, and he would come in dragging a tapeworm into the lecture. Essentially, he also was famous for discovering the cause of traveler's diarrhea. What we have now, he is long gone, but we have built up a robust programs in every continent around the world except Antarctica, and we've integrated it into the curriculum, which is no small feat. I mean, all of us can tell you how packed a curriculum is, medical school notwithstanding. We've just undergone a massive overhaul of the medical school curriculum, and global health is now an integral part of what we have introduced with the first year class starting last September. We have areas of concentration, which the student has to declare after the first year and a half of coursework. And there are about 40 of these things, global health being one of them. So a student who selects an area of concentration in global health will be expected to complete various requirements, educational, applied experiences, and some clinical work abroad, and then do a scholarly project, we call it that rather than a thesis, but every student before graduating with a medical degree has to prepare one of these scholarly projects. So what we have seen over the years as the interest in global health has increased, is that about 40% of the final year medical students, and I'm not challenging you with the math, we have 100 students, so 40% of the final year class goes abroad, and about 10 to 15% of the first year students go abroad during the first summer between the first and second year. And essentially what we're doing is integrating both an educational experience with courses that we have integrated into the curriculum, as well as now with a clinical experience. Some students may choose to take a gap year between third and fourth year where they can earn a Fulbright Fogarty Fellowship, a Doris Duke, et cetera. And they spend a year abroad, mostly doing research. It's very hard to do any sort of research project in 6 to 8 weeks, particularly in a different country. So we've integrated both clinical, educational, and research into the experience at Weill Cornell. And as I said, we have a very active student-faculty group. None of us have talked about that yet, and I want to come back and revisit that, because our program would not have succeeded without student and faculty input. So we have special committees to oversee what's going on and what more we can do. My office, I'm the director of the Office of Global Health Education, we oversee the educational components of global health within the medical school. We also pay the students, we pay their airfare and so forth. So if you can do the math quickly, each student who goes abroad will get about $2,000. I've already told you about 60 students go abroad, and my office is able to take care of that every year with the help of generous donors and so forth. So we have a lot to talk about. We also issue a certificate in global health for those that have completed the requirements of sort of this global health module. And we do recognize them at graduation. As a matter of fact, tomorrow I'm hosting our final event, welcoming back the international fellows, and the dean will speak and so forth. So we acknowledge, you know, all the efforts that go into making this program work, and we do appreciate, you know, the support of the administration, because without that, it wouldn't work either. So there's a lot we can talk about.
Great, thanks.
Okay, hi. My name's Terry Tucker. I'm representing the International Agriculture Rural Development minor, or major, I'm sorry, in CALS. It's an interdisciplinary major initiated in 2002. It's grown rapidly to 80-plus students. We have an interdepartmental College of Ag and Life Sciences advising team and curriculum committee. It's administratively nested within the International Programs CALS office, but the faculty who contribute to the program all have academic homes in other departments. Just real quickly, we require five primary elements: internationally themed coursework, you know, a small international ag common core plus internationally themed courses across the social sciences, the ag and environmental applied sciences, and the humanities. An international field experience tied to on-campus courses, either one semester or in some cases a two-semester sequence. Those courses are they always include an intersession field experience, faculty-led, but they're co-taught by faculty from overseas partner institutions and involve students from overseas partner institutions. So that enables team-based learning, research, reporting our students with their counterparts at overseas institutions. Part of that learning using that co-taught, co-located, real-life instruction you mentioned, and part of it in the field. We have required internships or other forms of engaged learning in low-income countries, usually semester-long or summer-long, and finally a senior capstone course, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, so thanks very much for your introductions, and I think all of you spoke to the internationalized nature of your curriculum, and you gave important examples. But I guess I'd like to ask, how is the curriculum for which you have responsibility, How is it different? And I guess what I really want to ask is, how are your students different as a result of the internationalized curriculum you have in place? I suspect that all of you have been exposed to curricula that is not so internationalized. So I'd like for you to speak to that. Professor Tucker, you may want to just respond quickly to.
Yeah, I was afraid you'd ask that question. You know, we have sort of a hunch of how they're different. We have very solid intended learning objectives, but our capacity for defining learning objectives exceeds our capacity for actually assessing learning outcomes. But all our students have had significant opportunity to work in developing countries with practitioner partners, with counterparts. So I think the ability to work cross-culturally, that's a very general way to state it, but work cross-culturally, the ability to be more reflective, to think more deeply about what they're observing, what they're learning, how those that they're interacting with are different in their circumstances are different than those that they've come to appreciate is, I think, is quite clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Certainly, I've heard that you sort of have to be a stone not to be changed by the experience, you know, going abroad. My students are placed in rural clinics in resource-poor areas, and some may actually do their international experience in Europe. That's fine. The whole point is to be in a different place, to see how medicine is practiced, mm-hmm. to make a diagnosis without all the fancy tools that they have at Weill Cornell. And to do so with an understanding and appreciation of different cultural norms, beliefs, and mores. And every one of them comes back somewhat changed. Whether they'll pursue something in global health is not the issue. The point is that they've seen how medical care is being delivered elsewhere. And to appreciate what they have here and appreciate the difficulty in trying to basically help others who are less fortunate. Just speaking personally, I oversee a very large cervical cancer screening program in rural India. We don't use pap smears. We can't. You know, there's not a lab. There are no cytologists. Basically, we use vinegar, acetic acid, 5%. And you see the ladies line up to be screened and so forth. That is extraordinarily moving. So what we try to do is to find programs that will be educationally and personally rewarding for the student and then have them write a reflection piece.
Great. Wonderful.
I would say ditto to both of you, both of what you've said. At the most fundamental level, their worldview expands. They realize, I think, the complexity and sometimes intractability mm-hmm. of public health problems. They may have had idealistic notions about the potential for themselves and others to solve these scourges in low-income countries, but they realize how difficult that is. Some of them thought maybe they were going into medical school afterwards, and they changed their mind and go into public health. Mm-hmm. Others think they were going to go into public health, and they decide to do something else. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of instrumental cognitive learning that happens, and then deep personal transformations as well.
Sure. Thank you.
Well, I can only echo what the previous speakers said. I think the international experience is just often deeply transformative for students. I work closely with my students really every step of the way, and so I can see the change in their work products, in their the way they interact in their performance moments, if they're appearing before a legislator or if they're appearing before a court, in the reflection papers that they write, in their interactions with their colleagues and with their clients and partners. I think that we see our students develop skills that they didn't have before, develop knowledge of international law and human rights tools, but also develop an appreciation of the complexity of these issues. And I think often start out a lot more humble and with a lot more questions than they did at the outset. And also, you know, I think that it helps to, that the international experience helps students to become more effective, but also really more thoughtful, with a sense of humility, with an appreciation for what they can learn from our clients and partners, as well as to what they can contribute to justice in the world.
Let me quickly respond to something you said by saying that some of you may recall a few years ago Justice Scalia actually ridiculing the value of international law, and I just leave it at that. You can ask the question and speak precisely about what you think the panelists should get at. So yes, please go.
Okay. In addition to all these transformative effects my colleagues already touched upon, I would like to emphasize perhaps two things as, you know, demonstrated in our students. One is our curriculum is really, really demanding. It's very rigorous, but also very, very demanding. So we, every year, on average, we have about 12 graduates of the CAPS majors. Now we are also having the CAPS minors, which started with small number. I think two points I would like to emphasize is, of course, with their language skills, which is a part of the, or half of their curricular requirements, their language skill really benefit them in a great way. And the importance of China or importance of China-U.S. relations for global security and the perspective cannot be emphasized enough. So we aim to train so-called the future or new generation of leaders in U.S.-China relations. I would say our small number of graduates are highly, not only highly motivated, they are really, truly dedicated. If they succeed in fulfilling all the requirements, they are already quite, you know, distinguished in so many ways. Second point I would like to emphasize, I think there, the difference the curriculum or the program makes can be manifested in their career paths. And again, I mean, being equipped with the knowledge about China and language skills and all these experiences, that's a huge selling point for our students in the job markets.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Wonderful, thanks. Yes, so please, you wanted the panelists to go a bit deeper.
None of the speakers have mentioned the outcome for the community. We're only talking about the outcome for the students. If we're talking about social change and human values, we need to address that first and foremost. Thank you.
Thanks. Would one or two of you respond quickly to that?
No, you bring up very good points, and given our constrained time, now is the time to elaborate on this. For all of the programs that I oversee at the medical school, it has to be a bilateral relationship. It's not to have my students go for 6-8 weeks, come back, and be changed, or so forth. Essentially, all the research that we do, all the research that I do, is overseen by colleagues on site. So it's not like we're just going and giving a student an experience and having them come back. We have long-lasting programs with many of hospitals and medical centers around the world where we are focusing on the benefits to those on the ground, to the patients, to the faculty, and so forth. It has to be bilateral. We also, as part of my office, have a visiting international student program where students from around the world can come and take clinical electives at Weill Cornell. And then they're hopefully going back to become leaders in their own country. So we give them this experience for a month or two, and we stay in touch with them. And we don't want them to go and apply for residency in the United States. We'd like them to stay in their home country. It has to be bilateral if it's going to succeed.
One more reaction.
Yeah, let me just read one of the intended learning outcomes for our program. But before I do that, let me just say that Dr. Charles talked about some of the grand global challenges of our era. And the ones that we give most attention to are food insecurity, poverty, nutrition and health, and sustainability of resources, natural resources. But one of the stated intended learning outcomes is for students to gain greater appreciation for the capacities of rural people in developing countries to define and propose solutions to their own problems and for the factors that limit rural people's agency. Now, we seek out opportunities for our students to be engaged in action work with good community-based partner organizations. And so the whole issue of impact, action, reciprocity, those are things that we do indeed think a lot about. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for your question. I suspect there may be other questions in the audience. While you're thinking about it, let me throw another question to the panelists. And I'd like two or three of you to respond to the question, what have you found to be the biggest challenge, or if you can't rank them, just an important challenge that you've encountered in trying to internationalize the curriculum and provide meaningful and rich international learning opportunities for your students? Anyone? Yes.
The first one is exactly the issue of mutual benefit. And so in our case, the majority of our students that go to a low-income country are going into established programs, partnerships that we have in four different countries, and embedding within an existing NGO in most cases. The other students find an NGO typically on their own and get involved in the work of that NGO. Investing usually faculty time in developing those partnerships and sustaining them over time has been a challenge mm-hmm. that we've had some success with. Another is ensuring equal access or equitable access to international experiences for the various kinds of students that we have at Cornell. Trying to prevent this from becoming sort of a privileged opportunity for some. So we spend a lot of time trying to help students find financial aid if they need it. And the third is dealing with the extra administrative demands mm-hmm. of doing this work.
Sure.
Clearly, it's different from campus-based instruction and curriculum per usual. And in these times and days, it's difficult to get the extra resources to do that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
I think I will point out two fold challenge mm-hmm. as a greatest challenge we are facing with. One is the while we have pretty rigorous curriculum focusing on the China studies, by creating Kapsminor 2 years ago, we intended to bring more Cornell students into our program, particularly in our overseas semester in China. But so far, that is a very challenging task for us. There are financial, administrative, and other factors which seem to be hindrance to our efforts. The second part of this is the faculty involvement. We have a small number of core faculties who are very dedicated to the curriculum, to the program as well. But how to get more faculty involved, in particular in our overseas operation, mm-hmm. that's also a challenge. Again, a similar side of financial and administrative and other factors involved there.
Okay.
So I'll mention two challenges as well. I think one, you know, goes back to your comment too, which is the tension I think that sometimes arises between, you know, our commitment to doing good work in the world and our professional obligations to our clients and partners, and then our pedagogical objectives of providing a really rich learning opportunity for our students. I think in the best of all worlds, and oftentimes those two goals coincide, but there are times when there is a bit of a balancing, you know, for example, in thinking about whether to include an international travel in a given project where it could be a really rich learning experience for the students, but its value to the community that we're working with is less clear. I think the other set of challenges that we face is just the practical challenges of doing cross-national lawyering, negotiating language barriers, working with partners and clients in different cultures, and particularly navigating in a field that is not always very clear-cut. Doing domestic advocacy is often much more straightforward in terms of how to define your objectives, how to define your strategies. But when you get into the field of international law, international advocacy, it's often very murky and not at all clear as to what the best strategy or combination of strategies will be. But I think that also makes it really exciting and provides really rich pedagogical opportunities as well as challenges.
Professor Frankel, you wanted to say something?
Just a couple of other things from our perspective. Is administrative support, and I don't mean just lip service, and that's been a challenge. The program, you know, has not evolved overnight. This program that we have, at least, and I'm sure your programs that you've discussed, you know, took years to develop and to gain acceptance. So certainly the faculty acceptance is an issue. Funding is always an issue that I suppose we should put number one. Mm-hmm. And then also managing risk in an uncertain world. Mm-hmm. How do we ensure the safety of our students, in all regions of the world?
Okay, so I'll provide another opportunity for questions. We have about five more minutes, but I'd love to... Yes, please.
Maybe more of a comment, but I just want to come back to your original question about basically what internationalization brings. And one of the things that's been somewhat surprising to me is that I've gotten pushback in some venues like this from, shall we say, more conservative folks, mm-hmm. About who, and you've probably encountered this too, Harvey, which is. Absolutely. An argument that this is mumbo jumbo. This is too much focused on cross-cultural awareness, mm-hmm. and the argument that I've made, which I think is a powerful argument, and I think we should make, is that this is not inconsistent with a commitment to one's own country's national security and one's own, in this case for many of us, U.S. global competitiveness. In other words, it's of paramount importance that we do this for the sake of American national security in foreign policy terms and also in terms of how the United States will ultimately compete in this more globalized world. So the emphasis should be, and for me primarily has been, on the students and what kinds of students we produce. And I totally agree with you that so many of the problems that we face internationally do not respect boundaries, and so we need to have the kinds of solutions that you suggested. Also important, as I articulated in terms of Cornell's international competitive position, because this is what universities are doing. But I just wanted to put a little footnote on your comment and question, that one can also speak about this in more kind of traditional nationalist terms, if you will.
Yes, and thanks so much for making that point. In fact, just last night I was considering whether I should add that to the list of rationales that I offered as to why internationalization matters. And then I felt that so much of federal funding, for example, and so many federal programs were established precisely for that reason. You know, the Title VI programs, just a raft of programs that I figured, well, we understand that. We take it for granted. But I think you're absolutely right to make explicit, particularly to some groups of people who need to hear a certain kind of rhetoric to, as it were, render their support in this cause. I believe we have one more minute, and I'd like to achieve the impossible by asking the final question, which is not what are not three things, but one thing you would like to be able to do to further enrich and enhance your international program that you haven't been able to do. So looking ahead, what you'd like to do, what you're hoping for.
Maybe 25 seconds. Actually, we are doing, this is something we have started to do, but we haven't been fully fulfilling or implementing what we initiated. That is the meaningful student interaction. Mm-hmm. between our students who are going to Beijing, stay at Beijing University, and students at Beijing University. Mm-hmm. And we started to open one of our core courses to students from both sides. And that is the start of our efforts. Eventually, we would like to open all our courses there to students from both sides.
So greater student interaction.
This is part of the networking build up. Also, this is the best possible constructive way to producing the next generation of leaders.
Great, thanks. We want to come down the, yeah, go right ahead.
So similarly, one of my goals is to develop projects that are really truly collaborative across cultures, and so engaging in projects that look at human rights issues or global gender justice issues abroad, but also back home in the United States, and involve collaboration with our partners, clinics in other countries, students in other countries, or organizations in other countries that maybe come here and get an international experience looking at the issues here in the United States and helping us figure out how to address them, just as we help them to figure out how to address problems in their own countries. And in doing so in a ways that are very consciously straddle different fields and different disciplines, working with not just within our narrow legal confines, but also recognizing that these are such complex global problems that we need to be collaborating with people from all different types of perspectives.
Thanks.
So the one thing I would mention, I think this one for a change is within our power to do. So many things are not, but this one is. I hope that we can master or be very successful in fully integrating student reflection into their curriculum, not only the experiential piece, but the parts that come before and the parts that come after, to find the ways to do this, to find the ways to motivate the students, to help them appreciate the importance of that for them, and for us to be successful in assessing that. We're still struggling with that, and to find perhaps a stable electronic platform, an e-portfolio, if you will, that we know the university will support from freshman year to their senior year and beyond, where they can put their reflections and it can be cumulative and accessible to others.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks.
I sometimes feel like Don Quixote, but I think what I would really like to stress is sort of the integration, the collaboration, the partnerships within Cornell University. We all have programs in similar parts of the world. I can send my medical team in, we could patch somebody up, but they're still going back to their unsanitary dwelling with sewage coming down the street. So I would really like to see how today and in the future, various programs could take a look. We could take a look at various programs and see where the similarity might be and how we might work together. I mean, we have a huge Cornell human rights program where we, do medical and mental health evaluations for asylum seekers. You know, we should be talking to you in the law school. So where is there similarity? Where is there synergism? And let's see if we can do something together.
Mm-hmm. Great.
My top one is very similar to David, so I'm not going to repeat that, but so I'm going to go down my list. The fact is we ask a lot of very busy people and very busy organizations when we ask them to host our student interns. But that said, we still need to find ways to engage them more fully in identification of learning outcomes and assessment. Mm-hmm. But they're sprinkled across the globe. You know, we're not doing a very much cohort model internships. You know, they're one-off internships in Burundi and Rwanda and Gabon and in Cuba and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's a challenge for us, but we need to get better at that.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and please join me in congratulating the panel.